Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Lee Boyce. And coming up, how much homeowners are making when they come to sell up is shrinking. Is it just another example of intergenerational unfairness? Is ISA season kicking off early as some juicy top rates hit the market? Lee has more. Inflation falls, so is the threat of stagflation over. And the jellycat craze continues to sweep Britain. Is it time to invest in the cult soft toys? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, the amount of money we're making when we come to sell our homes is shrinking. Now, that's according to new data analysis by estate agents Hamptons, who say returns from property have fallen to the lowest level since at least 2015 when they started recording this stuff. Last year, the average seller in England and Wales got around £11,000 less than had they sold in 2023 and about £21,000 less, if my maths is right, from the peak in 2022. Despite these lower price gains, 91% still sold their home in 2024 for more than they paid. So what does this all tell us? Simon Lee, welcome. Let's dig into the research a little more. Simon, 91% still sold their home in 2024 for more than they paid. It sounds a lot, but then you think about it, you think that's almost 10% who made a loss on their home. Is that presuming that they didn't hold it for so long? Like these are new buyers that had to sell? I mean, dig into this for me, Simon.
Yes, these are interesting stats. And the reason why I think that these are interesting stats is because unlike the slew of monthly house price reports that we get, this is the thing that really matters to people who own homes and sell homes and move home. It's what did you make on that property? And bear in mind that this is one of the only opportunities in life to make a large sum of money without paying tax on it, because your own home is exempt from capital gains tax. So it matters to people. But in a way, interestingly, for almost all of these people, it doesn't matter one jot and would do them a massive favor if there was a scenario where they'd made much less profit. Because, and we'll come on to that in a minute, the thing is, most of these people are going to sell their home and then they're going to buy another one. And in most cases, apart from when people are right at the top of the ladder, the kind of downsizing thing, they buy a more expensive home next. Or unless they maybe move to another part of the country. And even then, they're quite likely to buy a more expensive home next. So whilst they are in theory making their £91,820 profit on average after owning their property for 8.9 years on average, it doesn't do them any good whatsoever, because they're going to plough all of that money into buying another home that's more expensive, which the way these things usually work, because it's a more expensive home, started off as a more expensive home, will have gone up by more in value in monetary terms. So they're then going to have to find some extra money, which they're probably going to have to borrow on a mortgage, to lump into this, and they're just going to pay more money. And then at some point in the future, they will eventually be able to cash in on this. And I was thinking about this the other day when I was having a conversation with Tanya, and I think there's this general sense among people who should effectively be pretty affluent in the UK, a whole tranche of people between the ages of, like, you know, kind of 30 and 50, who, if you look at the statistics, are high earners, have lots of wealth because they own homes that on paper are really quite expensive and might have built up substantial amounts of equity, as reports like this show, but are just fed up with constantly feeling poorer. Feeling poorer in their own personal lives, as, you know, they get pay rises, but they seem to lose more than the pay rise to the rising cost of living and tax traps and so on, and the insane cost of buying a home and things, but are also fed up of getting poorer compared to everybody else in the world. We've talked about this on the podcast before, like how expensive it feels going to certain, you know, comparable countries in Europe and how expensive it feels going to the States. And you can fill us in on that in a minute because you've just been to San Francisco, right? So I think that there's this thing where we look at numbers like this, like people are making loads of money. And actually, they're not making anything. They're losing out. The only people making loads of money out of this are people who lend people mortgages, banks, basically, and the government cashing in on stamp duty. But anyway, to go back to it, to your question about the 9% who didn't make any money, I'm guessing that that 9% got quite unlucky and also are probably those who maybe moved, having bought potentially near the peak of prices, which, if you look back at the most recent run of house prices, we're talking pandemic boom. So we are now running into the scenario where there's going to be a sizable number of people, not that many, because most people stay for longer, but still a sizable number of people who bought a property in 2021, 2022, and are now moving. And many of those people might find that if they do need to move, that home is worth less than it was then.
I think that's exactly what happened to the people that owned my house, bought in 2021, sold it eventually in 2024, and I think for a bit of a loss there. And it was absolutely a pandemic move.
And actually, the people most likely to get caught out by this, there's two chunks of people, I think. Or maybe actually three chunks of people. I'll go three, right? Firstly, your biggest risk of doing this is if you buy a new build home, and then you move swiftly afterwards because new build homes are sold at premium prices. The reason why they're sold at premium prices is because developers can get away with it, and they're brand new. There's this idea of people do like buying a brand new home. Not everybody, but some people do. But obviously, once you've owned it, it's not brand new anymore. And some of that premium is going to get wiped out. Sometimes all of that premium can get wiped out. So those people are at risk. The other people who are at risk are the people who decided to do the kind of race for space stuff and moved out of cities into not necessarily far-flung locations, but the locations that are pushed further into the commuter belt, further away from stations. So I've seen this around by me out in commuter belt Hertfordshire, is there was huge demand for those, like, on the bits into the countryside kind of homes, nice big detached homes, big gardens and everything, pandemic. And actually now there seems to have been a flip around because people are expected back in the office, and they've suddenly discovered that actually, driving 15, 20 minutes to the station and then paying a gazillion pounds to park, etc., is not for them. And maybe they might have preferred to be closer to the station, etc. And also, then the third group I would say is that, like, the extreme race for space gang, the pandemic movers who decided that they were going to up sticks and like move to Devon because they weren't ever going to have to go back into the office again or up to, rural Yorkshire or off to Wales and all these kind of places, off to the coast. Those places, I think, are being hit hard as well. And they were once, red hot spots in the pandemic. And that's where the pain is being felt.
Hey, love. I just want to ask you about exactly what Simon said there. We are seeing many more companies talking about bringing people back to the office full time. What impact is that having, do you think? Is that a great news, a boon, I guess, for the cities and cities that have sort of suffered, the economies of the cities, housing? There's all sorts of things that are going to happen from that. What do you, how do you see it?
I think that the majority of people still didn't move millions of miles away. I think that, you had a small percentage of people that were doing that, but I think fully expectant that, you weren't going to be working from home forever. And, perhaps there would be some flexi working in the future, but not to base your whole life decision like moving millions away miles away from the office. And we have seen, not just in recent months, but in recent years, Georgie, where we've had, all sorts of companies and government bodies and whatnot kind of demanding people come back into the office. I think there was one in the news last week. It was one of the big banks saying,
JP Morgan, I think it was.
come back into the office. And then I was reading a story and it said, you've got to be in the office at least 2 days a week. I was like, wow, okay, that's not really that massive demand,
No.
is it? Two days
That's not
a week.
JP Morgan. That one is
No,
not
I think that
JP
was five
Morgan.
days a week.
Oh,
That's
yeah.
5 days.
That was what Leeds talking about is Lloyds, where they
Lloyds,
basically
yeah,
said the
Lloyds.
senior people weren't going to get their bonuses unless they were meeting the expectations of being in the office. And then you read the story and it was like the expectation was only being in 2 days. And you were like, guys, how are you not managing to achieve this? What you're talking about, Georgie, JP Morgan was 5 days.
Oh,
Yeah.
okay. There we go. So yeah, it's a mixed bag of what is expected. But you know, these big companies pay huge amounts of money to be in buildings, you know, in prime locations in cities. I mean, as someone that is in London pretty much all week, it's to be honest, it is a lot quieter than I think it used to be. But maybe that's just my mind playing tricks on me. I mean, I still sometimes can only just sort of smudge into the Central line into the morning. But I think really the change for that is just that the Elizabeth line exists and it's taken some of the strain off. So I think some of that has been a little bit overblown. You have the circumstance, I would say, in which people might end up not selling their home for a profit is a change in circumstances. So if you're going through a messy breakup or a divorce or something like that, and you are kind of like desperately trying to sell because you're trying to split the assets to them each buy a home, that kind of thing as well. But these stats really spoke to me, right? Because I'm someone that has lived in my current home for approximately 8.9 years,
Oh, wow.
as laid out in this piece of data from Hamptons, and where I actually we feel like trapped second steppers. So we skipped the first step when we bought a home. We didn't buy a small home. We bought a three bed house, and we knew we'd kind of grow into. But now we're kind of getting to the point where we feel like we're growing out of it. You know, families kind of expanded and whatnot. But the leap up from a sort of three bed semi to a four bed detached is absolutely astronomical, and it's exactly what you know Simon was describing there. You know, you kind of like we're sitting on a nice bit of equity on this house. We've been fortunate in terms of a low mortgage rate, overpaying it slightly. We're definitely in a position where the house price is up more than 91% as laid out in this study, but that next step up, it gives me sleepless nights when I start crunching mortgage rates where they are at now, how much I need to borrow from a mortgage lender in order to make that happen. And it's kind of quite off-putting. And that's not to mention things like stamp duty, which adds a sizable chunk onto it. But stepping back into these stats, I think a really, really clear thing is just how much the London boom has dissipated. So I think you ask anyone across the country, and I think there's a bit of a misconception that everyone in London is sitting on these sky-high house prices and making huge gains and blah, 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 blah. Now, that was true, looking at this study between April 2009 and July 2016. So just as we were coming out of the financial crisis, the average property in London rose in value by 94% from 245 grand to £475,000. However, since then, and up until the end of 2024, average London property is up 9%. That is an epic slowdown. And it's saying here flats and maisonettes in the capital only up 3% during that time. So it shows you that actually there's probably quite a lot of people that are sitting on homes in London that are struggling to potentially make much of a gain on it. And then drilling in into local sort of data and bringing it back to sort of last year, for the third consecutive year, house sellers in Wales made the biggest gross gains. Average home selling in 2024 for 48% more than the purchase price. Merthyr Tydfil replaced Barking and Dagenham as the local authority where sellers made the biggest percentage of gains nationally last year. It's quite interesting. You've got Barking and Dagenham and Waltham Forest, the two London boroughs that feature in the top 10 list. Still think of Barking and Dagenham as Essex, but that's just my own personal view. I know it's a London borough, but it's good to sort of drill into this and see where things are at, and that actually it's not buying a house in London doesn't necessarily result in sitting on sky high property gains. For me, I think that really does hammer home how much of the slowdown has been in the London property market. And is that some of that linked to the pandemic? Potentially.
There has been a rise in the number of homes making six-figure gains in the Midlands and the north of England, which is an interesting stat, I think, from here, that that's risen from 17% in 2016 to 29% in 2024. You've got to realize that obviously that's there's a you know there's an 8-year period there, so it's quite a large period of kind of house price inflation, but still, you know, to be bumping up into that six-figure gains. But I think what that shows is just it's really expensive to buy homes across a lot of the country now, particularly if you compare it to wages in the local area. And that goes back to something I would say on these statistics, which is like this is a problem. In that, if you think about this, there's another way of looking at this, and that's if you were going to buy your home now compared to 8.9 years ago, Like, and there'll be people listening to this who might have lived in their home for 8.9 years. Lee isn't the only person who's lived in his home for 8.9 years. You'd have to pay £92,000 more for it. And how are you going to find £92,000 more? Because there's another problem going on here, which is like mortgage rates are more like 4.5% now, and they weren't 4.5% 8.9 years ago. So it's going to cost you a lot more to borrow that. And this is a problem for first-time buyers. I mean, talking to people who own their own home and saying, well, if you were going to buy it now, it'd be more expensive, is all very well theoretically. And they go, oh God, I can never afford to buy my own home now. Thank God I actually already own it. But anybody listening to this who is a first-time buyer, a prospective homeowner who's hoping to own a home one day, or is renting and thinking they'll probably never own a home one day, is going to be listening to this going, oh my God, how am I ever going to do it? At this rate, it just keeps getting further and further away from me faster than I can save. And the ability to borrow more money is being shrunk by mortgage rates going up, which arguably is actually what we need in order to stop homes getting more expensive at the rate of, X amount every year, is that we need to, something needs to keep a cap on them. And the best way of keeping a cap on them is probably limiting the amount of money that people can borrow. And higher rates do that. But the issue is, as we've talked about on the podcast before, is that that involves a huge degree of short-term pain for anybody who's hoping to buy a property and is looking at it going, if only I could buy a property, because it would actually be cheaper than renting.
Simon, you raised the question of this intergenerational unfairness.
Well, there is a, yes, there is a degree of intergenerational unfairness, but it's not, you can't blame the older generation for it. They didn't, I don't think that they decided that they were going to push up house prices to an unaffordable level. It's a combination of things over the years. Some of it, you stretches out globally. The long-term decline in interest rates since the, 1980s, that then led to asset price bubbles, combined with the, insane monetary policy after the financial crisis, and then, into the pandemic years and everything like that. And some of it comes down to stuff that we haven't done, that we've done in this country. You can trace some of this back to loosening up borrowing rules in the 1980s, the deregulation of the of mortgages, where it meant that you didn't have to go and have an interview with your building society manager anymore. You could now get a mortgage from your bank, and it suddenly made it much easier to lend. But do we really want to go back to the days where you had to go have an interview with your building society manager, and women had to get it signed off by their husbands or another man that they could apply for a mortgage or something crazy like that? I mean, all those things do limit like what, how many people can buy, and limit borrowing. You've got the issue, of course, that, we don't build enough houses and we've got more people, but that's not the only thing. And that's why the whole, like, just build more houses doesn't work. You'd have to build an unbelievable amount of houses to counter the level of house price inflation that we've seen and get house prices back down to the long-term average compared to wages. That is primarily a function of cheap money. And also the fact that there's lots of people with loads of assets who don't even need a mortgage. There's only about 30% of people who own homes with mortgages now in this country. 30% mortgaged, 30% mortgage free, and about 30% renting. And I'm aware that doesn't add up to 100.
Near enough. Lee, you have another story on your website related to property, but it's talking about where in the UK asking prices went up the most last year. According to Rightmove, it was.
Sunbury-on-Thames, in
Right.
Sydney. Yeah, nice little part of the world. Asking prices were up 12.5%. Average home listed there, 593 grand compared to 527 grand a year before. But actually, this Rightmove data shows that as a whole, the average asking price across Britain last year was 1.4% higher. So it shows you that it's outperformed elsewhere across the country. There is actually a top 10 list, and it's quite a kind of really eclectic mix of places around the country. So we've got Sunbury-on-Thames top. It's followed by Bristol City Centre. So Bristol City
Wow.
Centre is thriving. Asking price there up 9%. Swinton in Greater Manchester also up 9%. And you've got Skemmersdale in Lancashire, 8.4%. Gosforth up in the Toon, 7.6%. But then we've got Swansea and Merthyr Tydfil, both up 7.3%. Darwin in Lancashire up 6.9%, North Shield 6.9%, and then Glenrothes in 6.8%. And the real kind of Sunbury really, really sticks out in that list compared to everywhere else in the country and Bristol, to be honest, because the rest of it is kind of, perhaps where you wouldn't have expected asking prices to have gone up so fast. And I guess the kind of looming thing that's happening now, especially I would say across London and the southeast, where house prices are still very high compared to the rest of the country, is the changes to stamp duty that are coming in on the 1st of April, just changing back to how things were before and what that could potentially do to the housing market, because people are on the whole probably going to be facing a higher stamp duty bill, especially if you're a first time buyer or you're not buying a mega home. People are looking at kind of a fair few grand extra. I think there's probably a lot of people that are trying to push purchases through now to try and beat that 1st of April deadline. It's really kind of skin in the teeth time now, because as people that have bought houses, we know how slow all of the transaction can go. And there'll be a lot of worried people out there be hoping that they can beat the stamp duty 1st of April deadline. And actually, there was an interesting stat in the story here. Again, it came from Hamptons, that the share of homes bought by first-time buyers across the UK increased to 31.8% in November and December, which is the highest figure on record. But first-time buyers currently we'll see the threshold of where you pay stamp duty fall from 425 grand to 300 grand. That means that for first-time buyers, instead of paying no stamp duty on a purchase if it was for about 425 grand, which, let's face it, in the southeast is pretty much where house prices sit at, they will soon pay £6,205. First-time buyer buying a home for £625,000. Now, granted, that's a fair chunk higher for a first-time buyer. They would currently pay 10 grand in stamp duty, but from 1st of April, that would be £21,250. That's an £11,250 jump. It's whether you could beat that or not. That's a big
If
old
you're
word.
talking about, oh God, if you're talking about intergenerational unfairness and stamp duty, I know there's that little band where, you get it, but that's a lot of money, isn't it, Lee?
Yeah, and the first time buyers are the kind of lifeblood of the property market, because without them, it kind of you need someone to be buying that first home for you in order you to buy the second home, and then so on and so forth. So it could have a big knock-on effect. I think that I don't know if it's going to be hard to sort of predict, but a lot of people are fed up with stamp duty charges and the high cost of a five-figure stamp duty bill. I was watching Kirsty and Phil on Love It and List It this week, and they're talking about, should we spend 100 grand doing up our home? That's the premise of the program. They spend money to do up their own home, and then Phil goes off and says, look, you could buy this. And like, some of these homes were absolutely stunning, we found with kind of in budget. And then they flash up how much it's going to cost stamp duty and moving costs, and 30, 40 grand. And you're thinking,
Just shocking, isn't
money,
it?
money,
Because
money
it's
for old rope, like,
But it's dead money to you. Do you know what I mean? You don't
Yeah.
get it back. It's just like it's not like it can invest that. Simon, you're shaking your head there.
Stamp duty is a terrible tax. It's really bad. It inhibits movement, stops people moving home, gums up the property market. It limits like people moving for work, so it's anti-growth in that sense. It's a real anti-growth tax. Until Gordon Brown started meddling with it, we survived with a flat stamp duty rate of just 1% on all properties over £60,000, which obviously would be higher nowadays. Gordon Brown, George Osborne, all of the chancellors since, 14 years of Tory chancellors, and they didn't sort out stamp duty is pretty disgraceful. And then Rachel Rees has made a big mistake just reverting it back to where it was. We should bin it. It's a terrible tax. Don't just take my word for it. The IFS says the same thing.
Yeah, it's not going to change that, is it?
No, this is the problem. We've painted ourselves into a corner, haven't we? With so many bad taxes that we're now like, well, we can't afford to change them. When actually, the greatest benefit we could have to growth in this country would be just to rip up all those bad taxes and go, right, blank slate, start again, which is what I was hoping for, but we didn't get after the disappointment of 14 years of the Tories making taxes even worse.
We'll leave property to one side, and we've got a ways to go until the end of the tax year. But Lee Boyce, we're seeing some juicy ISA rates hit the market, are we not? So, has ISA season kicked off already? Lee, what's going on out there? What are we looking at here?
Yes, I think we can safely say that there is a bit of an early cash ISA season going on here. We have seen some rates being driven by firms that you might not necessarily immediately associate with offering savings rates, which I'll get to in a minute. But let me paint the picture of where we're at in the kind of world of ISAs. There are 53.9 billion pounds worth of fixed rate cash ISAs set to mature between now and April. That is a huge amount of money.
Wow.
That is money people have locked away in 1 year fixes, 18-month fixes, and 2 year fixes. So the big question will be for those people that see those accounts mature, where to head next. Now, a year ago, you could have got a fixed rate that's going to be better than what you can get for a year now. There's no doubt about that. 2 years ago, actually, you can get better rates now compared to what the best 2 year fixes were about 2 years ago. But we're in a sort of strange time, I would say, in the savings market in general, but especially cash ISAs, because we have got a number of cash ISAs that are paying beyond 5%, which is quite rare compared to where things have gone. So a year ago, the best 1 year fix you could have got was offered by Virgin Money. It had 5.25% rate. So you're not getting a 1 year rate that's going to get anywhere near that now. You're looking more at 4.5% best buys. But as I said, the easy access market might be where you want to head next, just to park the cash while you decide what to do with it. I mean, whatever happens, if you are someone that's about to see their cash ISA mature, make sure you do something with it. Don't let it drop onto a kind of variable rate. From especially from big banks, etc. Not that big banks are really out there offering great cash ISA rates, but you've got to make sure that your money's not just rolling over into something absolutely rubbish. Now, this leads me on nicely to where we're at in the easy. I'm just going to talk about easy access cash ISAs here because this is where all the competition is being driven at the moment. There's a real race for
Why?
cash ISA money because they know how much money is sloshing about in tax-free ISAs. We have come off the back of a year or two where cash ISAs have been in absolute sharp focus for people. They have been really having their moment in the sun. People have been piling in billions and billions and billions, tens of billions into tax-free accounts to try and dodge the personal savings allowance and making sure that they're not getting taxed on the interest that they earn on their savings. That's the nub of it. People have really wised up. People are already savvy enough to have ISAs and build up ISA pots. And we've talked in the past about people who have managed to become ISA millionaires and all that kind of thing. But for the average man on the street, average person on the street, it's kind of there is a real world possibilities the last couple of years that you would have been getting charged tax on your savings interest because of how the personal savings allowance works, which I won't go into in ins and outs because we've been in the ins and outs of it many times before. But you can now get a cash ISA for 5.05%. I should point out here that this is an exclusive rate, so this is money. So if you want to open this up, you'll have to go and find the article on our website. It is via Trading 212, which is an investment platform. So this is what I mean about it being an unusual choice. You just need £1 to open it. It's FSCS protected. That's the crucial thing. Always make sure that your savings are FSCS protected. We would never ever suggest a kind of savings account that doesn't fall under that remit. So that is the very best cash ISA you can get right now. Trading 212. You want to come on the Some Money website if you want that. We've also got Plum at 5.01%. So again, above 5%. You've got Moneybox also offering 5%. So a little bit different from the Trading 212. They aren't investment platforms. You've got Chip at 4.85%. You then have to go quite far down the tables to get names that I would say are familiar to the everyday person. So in our tables, we've got Monument Bank, then next up, then Mansfield Building Society, very small building society. The first real big name I would say that is in our cash ISA tables is Virgin Money, 4.51%. So it shows you the big gap between what is being offered by kind of these smaller challengers who are looking to hoover up money from savers who are looking to put their tax-free savings somewhere. It's also is making sure that you know all the ins and outs of your cash ISA because things have changed a little bit and got a little bit more complicated. So you want to probably make sure, depending on how you're going to use it, but having a flexible ISA is a pretty good idea. This lets you sort of dip in and out of your ISA without there being a problem over the tax year. You have to make sure that it's in the tax year. You can replenish it, you can put it back in, but not all ISAs allow you to do that. So you need to make sure from your terms and conditions before you do it that it is a flexible ISA. The Trading 212 Best Buy is a flexible ISA.
Really love. We said at the start this is quite early for an ISA season quote to kick off. So is it a sort of actually this could get better? Wait and see.
I think this is a bit of a precursor of what's to come. And the reason why I say that is because I still think that there's room for some of the bigger names, some of the more established brands to kind of bring out better rates. Actually, some of the big banks had some okay-ish rates, sort of February, March, April last year. And we're still well ahead of the new tax year that starts on the 6th of April. So there's a lot of room to grow. It's just that the easy access rates on these cash ISAs are really bucking the trend of the overall savings market because across the board, really, we have seen falls. It's the one bit that is kind of remaining propped up a little bit and where you can still get plus 5%. And we're in a rare position. You can't even fix a cash ISA for 5 years to get a better rate than 5%, which usually, everything's been flipped on its head. Like usually you would say the longer you fix, the better the rate you're going to get. At the moment, it's still just not that way. It hasn't been that way for a little while. So to get a plus 5% rate, the only way you can currently do that with a savings provider with FSCS protection is through getting an easy access cash ISA. But and the other thing I should say, if you're tempted by this, before you just go and take the plunge, make sure you go and kick the tires on all of these providers. As in, make sure if something goes wrong, how quickly is something going to be fixed? How good is the customer service? Seamless is it, to get the app and open it? All of these accounts really now these days are app only. You're going to have to download the app and be comfortable applying. I would have thought most of our listeners have fallen into that category. But make sure that you go off and do your research before you just blindly put your money into any of these providers. I personally haven't opened an account with Trading 212, so I can't sit here and say it's a brilliant place. All I can tell you is that it's got a rate of 5.05%, and that's the best rate at the moment. Most of these digital challenges, though, are pretty nimble, have been built as apps, so it's quite seamless usually. But any problems, or if you've got an ISA provider you'd like to recommend, do get in touch.
Also,
Diamond. just to make a point on Trading 212's ISA and some of these ISAs with the investment platforms. When we talk about them being cash ISAs and when we feature them in our cash ISA tables and our five of the best cash ISAs, that's because they are actually cash ISAs. This is not money being paid on cash held in your investment account. Or sometimes I see reader comments saying, come on, be honest, these are money market funds. And it's like they're not money market funds. You're not holding your money in money market funds. That's a different thing. You can hold your money in a money market fund in an investment ISA, stocks and shares ISA, but this is not. These are proper cash ISAs. So that's another thing to check if you're going to sign up to an ISA from something that, isn't a traditional bank or building society. But, when we talk about these being cash ISAs, they are cash ISAs.
You're still sending out your savings email, are you?
Savings alerts. Yes. Come to thisismoney.co.uk/savings alert, and you will get an email in your inbox when the hottest deals land.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Alex Webbone of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Alex, a topical question from a listener here. I've read about yields rising to around 5%. Are government bonds a good investment?
Hi, Simon. So, yes, government bonds, otherwise called gilts, can be a good choice if you're looking for a low-risk investment with a predetermined and stable returns when held to maturity. So, in other words, you'll know the rate of return you'll be receiving and for how long you'll receive it from the outset. So, for example, if you're buying a gilt with a 5% yield, you will receive 2.5% every 6 months. This is called the coupon. The benefit of gilts is that they're also very low risk. So they're backed by the British government, which means there's a minimal chance of a default. And I think I'm correct in saying the government has never defaulted on gilts. The benefit of this to a portfolio is that it makes them a useful diversifier, especially if your portfolio is quite equity dominant. And if you're looking to de-risk, then they're quite a sensible strategy. They're also very liquid if you do decide to sell. It's worth noting that gilts can do particularly well if inflation and interest rate expectations fall, but predicting that can be very difficult.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
Welcome back. Inflation unexpectedly dropped in December to 2.5% from 2.6% in November. Now, not a massive change, but one that is closer in the direction of the Bank of England's 2% target. We also importantly saw core inflation from 3.5% fall to 3.2%. Services inflation again reached its lowest level in nearly 3 years. So does that mean, Simon Lambert, the spectre of stagflation is disappearing? What will it mean for rates, and could inflation tick higher? First of all, dig into the weeds, if you would, Simon. What did we get in December? It was a bit unexpected.
Yeah, it was. I tell you what, that Rachel Reeves is an economic genius. Inflation down, growth up this week. Wowza. Yep. Amazing. Unbelievable. Look, you can't read too much into 1 month's figures, as I facetiously just indicated there. Okay, inflation did tick down. It ticked down, you know, a huge 0.1%, you know, from 2.6 to 2.5. But actually, more importantly, it was, what was that compared to what was expected? And what was expected was that it was going to go up again. And the fact that it not only went down, but it didn't go up again, is actually the more important bit. As you said, core inflation down. The biggest movers here, largest contribution came from restaurants and hotels, and followed by the cost of alcohol and tobacco falling. I don't know why the cost of tobacco fell, which is a bit weird. I think it was mainly alcohol in that, and it's just in the category. Clothing and footwear. And food inflation stands at 2% in the year to December, which is unchanged from the month before, but it was 19.2% in March 2023. So that is, you know, good news. This indicates that we possibly don't need to freak out about as much about inflation as we maybe were from some slightly higher figures recently. We were having a little one of our mini inflation freakouts. I still think inflation will probably prove a bit stickier than people think. But I also think there's a lot of disinflationary stuff going on in the economy. By disinflationary, I mean things that will pull inflation down, not deflationary, things that will make prices go down. And that we may be underestimating some of that stuff in terms of actually people just feeling the squeeze versus the inflationary stuff going on in the economy, which is kind of, you know, the sticky price of the inputs for businesses, one of which is obviously wages, which is becoming more expensive due to the national living minimum wage, or whatever it's officially called, going up, but also due to the employer national insurance costs that were added in the budget and the lowering of the level at which they kick in. The question is, are we going to see a rate cut? And it's astonishing. Like last week, February rate cut was out the window. We were not getting a February rate cut. There was no chance of it happening. This week, it's like, oh, might have a February rate cut back on the cards. Someone referred to it as a sure bet.
Wow.
I'm not sure it's a sure bet, but I did read an interesting comment on this, which was that one of the reasons for the bank to cut in February would be, if they don't cut in February, then you're going to end up with, if they want to get the cuts in that they're talking about this year, they're going to be too close bundled together. So by cutting in February, they managed to space it out a bit. And that might be something that does come into MPC members' minds when they cast their vote.
Just a quick one. I mentioned their stagflation. What is it? Will we get it?
The stagflation is the unwelcome return of something from the 1970s. Basically, it's a stagnation in the economy combined with inflation in the economy, which is bad news because usually inflation comes from growth. And if you get a bit of inflation, but it's coming because the economy is growing well, then that's not necessarily a problem. If you get a scenario where you've got a stagnant economy and inflation, well, that's bad news. And one of the places where that's bad news is government bonds. Go back to last week's podcast, listen about that, because Inflation drives up interest rate expectations. Interest rate expectations have a major impact on what the cost of government borrowing is going to be and how much people demand in order to lend money to your country. And if you have a stagnant economy, you're not earning more money in order to pay those bills.
Are we anywhere near like the 70s? I mean, we're talking about here inflation at 2.5%. Growth is rubbish. But like, I mean, it slightly went up, didn't it? I mean, is it fair to make that sort of a comparison? Or is it really any higher inflation and stagnation together?
Well, you can see why members of the boomer generation, talk about how we don't know what we're complaining about.
Yeah, you've never had it so good.
High interest rates at 5%, high inflation at, 2.5%, that kind of thing. But you've got to also look at the fact that in the 70s, when you had this problem, people's wages were going up at pretty much the same level as inflation. I mean, that obviously contributes to its own economic problems, but it all comes out in the round, doesn't it? I don't think we're back to the 1970s, no. The 1970s were a uniquely economically painful time for the UK. Mm. And I don't think we're heading back there yet.
Yet. Yet. All right then, jellycats of all things. Yes, jellycat fever continues to strike Britain. This is Money has the ultimate guide to the ridiculously expensive soft toys that you can buy and flip, apparently, for more than £2,500. Lee, for anyone who doesn't have kids or an interest in expensive soft toys, jellycats, what are they? They've been around for a while, haven't they? But this is the last sort of year or so there's been a sort of investment fever almost around them.
It's gone Beanie Babies 2.0, hasn't it, Georgie? It's like the new generation of
Beanie Babies.
Yeah, that was in the collecting corner a little while back when we got our columnist Dan Hatfield to have a look at the Beanie Baby phenomenon and how it sort of really bubbled and then popped and never really recovered.
No more.
I would say that jellycats are different. You know, they're British for one. They were founded by a British brothers in 1999, and they've kind of gone crazy on social media. Now, if you haven't got children, they are basically just soft toys, but they are kind of quite unusual. They're quite nice looking. We've got a few knocking around in the house, no doubt. And the reason for that is that they seemingly have taken over garden centres. So I spend an inordinate amount of time pottering around garden centres as a dad of two young children. And also my wife had a family business that involved garden centres. So I'd spent quite a lot of time. Some of the displays that they put these jellycats on are absolutely incredible. And they're kind of a bit different to the sort of Beanie Baby craze, in which you do have like the kind of animals and the pets, but they do kind of unusual ones. So for a good example of that is
toast, marshmallows,
things like that, like food stuff,
avocados
is a good example. The other example I was going to give, it went all over social media, I couldn't move for it, was the fish and chip shop that they set up in Selfridges, where basically they sold, you guessed it, a lily fish for 40 quid, cozy chips for £50.
£50!
Dot and Peggy mushy peas, £40. These things aren't cheap, Georgie. They are not cheap. They're pretty expensive. So what we're talking about here in this jellycat kind of craze is, if you go back now and look at some of the kind of original ones that are now, pretty rare, because let's face it, if you buy a child a toy like this, it's probably going to have the labels ripped off. It's probably going to be chewed on. Mm. It's probably going to be, all sorts of dragged around in all sorts of places. But some of the ones that are discontinued, retired jellycats, which is where it makes me think of Beanie Babies 2.0, because this is the kind of strategy that they had, can go for quite a lot of money. So, for example, that £2,400 you talk about there is for a bungly mouse that cost in £20 in 2005, can now sell for about £2,500. And other retired ones, Bashful Bunny Dixie, Rumpelkin Frog, Bashful Bunny Lucy, they all go for around about £2,000 mark. Now, Peter Jenkinson, who's a toyologist, which I think is the best kind of like
great job,
however, studies the investment returns of the toy market, and he says only now is jellycat achieving cult status, making the rarest must-haves highly collectible. So what I would suggest here is to go and have a dig around. I mean, honestly, if you came into my house, this is no word of a lie, I reckon I have somewhere between 100 to 200 soft toys dotted all around the house in various ways, shapes and forms. Because, companies like Jellycat are clever. You go to a garden centre, daughter sees something fun and adorable, like a marshmallow, daddy, 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 please. And that, you know, no. But then once in a while, you might get hit on a soft point and go, oh, all right, then. If that's what you want to spend your birthday or Christmas money on or whatever, that's fine by me. So it's worth having a dig around. Now, that fish and chip shop, let me weed back to that. It was massively popular on social media. What they did was they had staff working. You'd order like your fish, your chips, and they'd wrap it up and make it all look nice. And it went kind of all mad on social media, right? And as well as those ones I just mentioned, there was Charlie Chip, Clement Lemon, Vinny Vinegar, Salty Steve, which is a could be my spirit animal, if I'm being honest. On the day, to buy the whole set, £216.
Whoa.
To buy the whole set now, you can get it on eBay for about £350. So that's a 62% jump if you've got the full collection looking all nice and neat. However, you can still buy the items separately for not much more than what they were sold on the day. So you have to be a little bit careful of what you call eBay scalping. That is when people list things on eBay for huge amounts of money and you think, oh, it must be worth that. But of course, they're just chances in their arm. You know, you want to look at sold prices. You want to look at actually where the market is heading. So another example of that is that they had a cherry cake that was sold at Harrods with a limited edition Harrods box. It was available in the store for £45 last year. Now, there was examples on eBay of these being listed for about £150, which is a massive leap in the space of, you know, a few months. Realistically, it was selling more like for £60 on eBay. So you have to be really, really, really careful. But these things do hold their value. And actually, I know for a fact, I would say we've got probably 5 jelly cats knocking around in that whole collection I was just talking about. And we do actually leave labels and things when they're expensive like that. Stife bears and things like that that we've been gifted over the years. Like there's some stuff I just think, just keep the label on that one. You know, everything else, take the label off. I know for a fact that I could sell them on Facebook Marketplace probably for in or around how much they were bought for. They hold their value. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to make huge profits on these, but as anyone with children can probably kind of tell you, a large chunk of things that children get gifted is plastic tat. It's rubbish. It has no resale value. It can be very hard to get rid of, and you end up binning it or donating it to a charity shop. There are some toys and some things that you know will sell again. If you kind of list it on a local marketplace or eBay, if you want to try and drive the price up a little bit higher, Jellycat firmly falls into that category. So that's what this Jellycat. I felt like this was like a little Lee collecting corner story just to throw in at the end here, because you know I'm interested in all this kind of stuff. And there's a real big back catalogue of Jellycat toys. It is well worth going to see, especially if you've had children and you've been gifted these, going round them all up, and all the details on the label. If the labels come off, it's not going to be worth as much, but you can still probably sell it. And it might just be that you've got one of those rare ones that are worth a couple of grand. Very unlikely, but not completely outside of the realms of possibility. And if, again, if anything like my wife, who I'm not going to call her a hoarder because that's unfair, but she definitely likes to keep hold of the kind of nice things that were gifted to our eldest daughter now, who's 6, in a box, in the loft, and doing the same again for our baby, who's about 9 months old. I know that she will put lots of things in a box that are kind of special from, you know, people are very generous and very kind when you have a baby. And, you know, on the whole, don't want to buy you just some rubbish. It gets worse as the years go on, you know, they kind of make less effort and you end up with the plastic tap. But in the beginning, quite often things like jelly cats are gifted. And actually, we had one gifted over Christmas for my baby, for my brother, a little snowball with a little face on, a little arms and legs with a label on. We'll keep hold of that. Surefire way to make some money over Christmas if you ever want to get rid of it.
Question is, though, Lee, would you prefer a bashful Luxe bunny willow for your little girl, or £33 in premium bonds? Obviously, it doesn't really work, £33, but like, let's say £50.
Definitely the Jellycat. Definitely. Yeah. I like premium bonds, but as someone.
No, you don't, Lee. You're annoyed at premium bonds right now.
Still haven't won a prize. And you know, saving and investing for your children's future is important. I personally veered down a different investing route for my children, which is to actually just invest in the stocks and shares ISA rather than putting money in premium bonds with no guarantee of returns that could just be eaten away by inflation over the years. I actually think that a Jellycat, they get the immediate kind of hit and excitement of having it and cuddling it and enjoying it, and it probably won't lose its value, or if it does, it will lose partial value. And but you've also had the enjoyment of having it. And actually, I always say, if you are interested in investing in a kind of collectible like this, it has to be something that you're into and enjoy. Because at the end of the day, like Beanie Babies, if it all just crashes and you were left with 50 Beanie Babies, you'd like to think that you like those Beanie Babies. You've bought them for a reason. There's something you wanted and something that you've enjoyed. It's like why I've invested in retro gaming stuff, because I just know that if that value all just tanks, I won't really care. I'll just get my Nintendo GameCube out and play some of the games that I've been buying up, and it's fine, isn't it? Like, you know, I'm left I'm left holding something that I enjoy, so it's fine. And that's the way you've got to look at these kind of collectibles.
And they are very cute. Honestly, have a look at the website. I've only seen them like in the little concession shops in, say, Waterloo Station. But they are, I mean, ignoring the price, because I wouldn't spend that sort of money on a soft toy.
The next time we record this podcast, I'm going to see just like mountains of Jellycats behind you. You're going to become like a mad Jellycat lady. Is that what's going to happen?
If I had money, Lee.
They're very clever. They are well made. They are kind of like
British as well. I like that.
They're British, and they kind of hit on trends. You know, I think it's been a kind of exercise in how to build a business fairly slowly off the ground. And it's just now, as was pointed out by the toyologist, this is when it started to reach cult status. Mm. And I can totally understand it. I can totally see it. And I was having this conversation with someone in our commercial department in the week when we were talking about Jellycats. And he said, oh, my word. You know, I think his children are 12 and 14, and they both put quite expensive Jellycats on the top of the list. And both of the ones that they wanted were sold out everywhere.
Wow.
In which I said, did that turn you into Arnold Schwarzenegger out of Jingle All the Way when he's looking for Turbo Man? And he said it wasn't far off. So there is that phenomenon there. And you've got to remember a child that's 12, 14, they've grown up with all these Jellycats. They've seen them all the time. And it proves that you don't have to have a kind of a toy or something that does loads of things that's kind of technological, you know, and or linked to a TV program or a film or whatever. You know, there's no Jellycat TV program or film. It's just its own entity. And a lot of what's happened in the last sort of 5 years around it is, as I say, I think they've taken over garden centres. Next time you're in a garden centre, I almost guarantee there will be a display of Jellycats somewhere. Mm. It's got into our psyche that way. And then if you're on social media, it's quite possible that you've seen Jellycat stuff and posts and whatnot.
Yeah.
So it's been a clever way of building the business.
All right, then. I'll look out for it the next time I'm in a garden centre, Lee, which is not often, I'll tell you that much. Right. It is a podcast reader question time. And the winner of the This Is Money mug this week is James. And the question is, what is the best pension saving strategy for a married couple with different income levels? So, James says, my wife and I are in our late 40s with two school-aged children and share all of our finances. We own our house outright in joint names, having recently paid off our mortgage. We have a single joint bank account and ISA savings that we consider to be joint assets. Now, James is a 40% taxpayer, and in recent years, he's overpaid into his defined benefit pension scheme in order to avoid the child benefit tax trap, so pension pot looking rather healthy. My wife did not work for several years when we had children, and she went back part-time. She was initially earning below the personal allowance, therefore paying zero income tax, so it seemed sensible to only pay the minimum required into her pension to get the employer contribution and pay any extra that we could afford into my pension to get the 40% tax relief. She is now a basic rate taxpayer, but we have continued the same pension saving strategy, so her pension pot is much smaller than mine. However, I have recently been wondering whether this is indeed the best strategy, or if it may come back to bite us in retirement when we start drawing income from my pension savings alone. Thank you very much, James. Mug will eventually be on its way to you. Simon.
Okay, so James, this is a great question. It's a long question, but it's a great question. Now, what you and your wife have been doing is A, pretty well financially, because you've said you paid your house off. You manage all your money jointly, but you've also been thinking about this in the way of maximizing the tax relief that you can get on your pension. So you've been overpaying into your defined benefit pension scheme. Now, the other crucial bit of information here is obviously that you're a 40% taxpayer and you have a defined benefit pension scheme, which means that you are going to have an employer that says you pay in what you pay in, they'll pay in what they pay in, and they will guarantee you a set amount of money in retirement. So it's on them, not on you, as it would be with a defined contribution pension. If this was a defined contribution pension, you were doing this, what you'd effectively be doing is building up your pension pot even more to buy yourself your retirement income. So I'm guessing from this that these overpayments mean that you're going to be nicely bumping up that income that you're going to get in retirement from your employer. Now, as you mentioned, what this potentially means is that you're going to find yourself being a higher rate taxpayer in retirement. And that means that some of that pension income, which as it's a defined benefit pension, you can't decide to like only take a certain amount as you can with a defined contribution pension. You're going to get paid that money. Some of that risks being taxed at 40%. Whereas your wife, who has lower pension savings, if she were drawing a pension income, then she would only be being taxed at 20% potentially. Or sometimes, you know, if you're below that personal allowance, even less, but your state pension counts towards that as well. And that's the other thing to remember. Remember your state pensions here. So yes, in theory, it might possibly be worth you sacrificing a bit of tax relief now to get some more money into your wife's pension. You're also effectively spreading your risk a little bit here. You're diversifying, because it sounds here as if your wife's pension would be a defined contribution pension, and in which case you're going to have two pensions. One that's defined benefit, where you've got that nice guaranteed amount that you're going to get paid, but that's only going to go up in line with inflation and your wages, you know, that kind of thing. And then you've got this other one, which is the investment pot, which the risk is on you, but there is also a chance that that could do really, really well and grow to a better amount than you think. What you've got to remember, though, is that you're giving up that reduction in your income now, and you sort of need to do the maths. I actually think that seeing as you are in the position of having a good defined benefit pension, thinking about trying to get some more money into your wife's pension, and also you've got that house paid off, mortgage free, all that kind of stuff, I actually think it would be a good idea to have a conversation with a financial planner here. I think you're in the position where the cost of that would pay off. And maybe an idea might be to go down the route of doing one of these coaching sessions that you can do for free. So for example, Charles Stanley, the podcast sponsor, they do free financial coaching sessions. You don't have to be a customer. You can ask them the questions. They'll be able to give you a bit more information. And if you think it's worthwhile you taking financial planning, you could look at doing it with them. You could look at doing it with anyone. But I do think this is a situation where that might pay off.
All right then, and it's Simon's stat of the week to end on. Simon, what have you got for me?
Investment platforms. Freetrade was one of the platforms that came into the market and shook things up by offering free share dealing, and was one that absolutely boomed during the pandemic. There was talk that it was going to become a unicorn, so worth $1 billion. Dollars. I don't think it ever quite got to unicorn status, but it did a crowdfunding and fundraise in 2021 with a valuation of £650 million. It has now been sold to IG Group for £160 million, which means that there are potentially a sizable number of crowdfunding investors who have lost out. In fact, we had a tweet from one yesterday that we carried on the site when we had the story, who said they invested £30,000 in January 2021. Today, I'm being forced to sell my shares at £1.19 each for £3,800. So that's a loss of £26,200 in the original outlay. We were contacted by someone else who directed us to a Reddit thread where there's a lot of very disgruntled free trade investors. I think this illustrates two things. You know, one, nothing is a sure bet. And even though it looked amazing for free trade at the time, you know, things do change. And you got in that pandemic peak was just a kind of like, it was an outlier scenario. And two, you've got to spread your risk, because I'm guessing the person who put £30,000 in, it wasn't only like 1% or 2% of their portfolio, you know, their overall investment portfolio. I'm guessing it was much more. And crowdfunding is really, really high risk investing. You know, when if you venture capital trusts invest into hundreds of companies and they expect most of them never to succeed, and just the few that do succeed, you know, they pay the returns that mean it's worthwhile doing it. So that's what crowdfunding investors do need to remember. And anybody listening to this who did invest in free trade and has lost money, I feel for you.
All right, then, that is it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us on @thisismoney. And you can also go and post comments on where this podcast will live on the website.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.